insisted both publicly and privately that the great honor of a Nobel should not be given to a highly speculative theory that was the subject of an inexplicable mass hysteria that would soon deflate. Instead of choosing someone else, the Academy did something that was less, or more, of a public slap at Einstein. It voted to choose nobody, and tentatively banked the 1921 award for another year. The great impasse threatened to become embarrassing. His lack of a prize had begun to reflect more negatively on the Nobel than on Einstein. Imagine for a moment what the general opinion will be 50 years from now if the name Einstein does not appear on the list of Nobel laureates, wrote the French physicist Marcel Brillouin in his 1922 nominating letter. To the rescue rode a theoretical physicist from the University of Uppsala, Carl Wilhelm Ossain, who joined the committee in 1922. He was a colleague and friend of Gullstrand, which helped him gently overcome some of the ophthalmologist's ill-conceived but stubborn objections. And he realized that the whole issue of relativity theory was so encrusted with controversy that it would be better to try a different tack. So Ossain pushed hard to give the prize to Einstein for the discovery of the law of the photoelectric effect. Each part of that phrase was carefully calculated. It was not a nomination for relativity, of course. In fact, despite the way it has been phrased by some historians, it was not for Einstein's theory of light quanta, even though that was the primary focus of the relevant 1905 paper. Nor was it for any theory at all. Instead, it was for the discovery of a law. A report from the previous year had discussed Einstein's theory of the photoelectric effect, but Ossain made clear his different approach with the title of his report, Einstein's Law of the Photoelectric Effect, emphasis added. In it, he did not focus on the theoretical aspects of Einstein's work. Ossain specified instead what he called a fundamental natural law, fully proven by experiment, that Einstein propounded. The mathematical description of how the photoelectric effect was explained by assuming that light was absorbed and emitted in discrete quanta, and the way this related to the frequency of the light. Ossain also proposed that giving Einstein the prize, delayed from 1921, would allow the Academy to use that as a basis for simultaneously giving Niels Bohr the 1922 prize, because his model of the atom built on the laws that explained the photoelectric effect. It was a clever coupled entry ticket for making sure that the two greatest theoretical physicists of the time became Nobel laureates without offending the Academy's old-line establishment. Gullstrand went along. Arrhenius, who had met Einstein in Berlin and been charmed, was now also willing to accept the inevitable. On September 6, 1922, the Academy voted accordingly, and Einstein and Bohr were awarded the 1921 and 1922 prizes, respectively. Thus it was that Einstein became the recipient of the 1921 Nobel Prize, in the words of the official citation, for his services to theoretical physics, and especially for his discovery of the law of the photoelectric effect. In both the citation and the letter from the Academy Secretary officially informing Einstein, an unusual caveat was explicitly inserted. Both documents specified that the award was given without taking into account the value that will be accorded your relativity and gravitation theories after these are confirmed in the future. Einstein would not, as it turned out, ever win a Nobel for his work on relativity and gravitation, nor for anything other than the photoelectric effect. Einstein was traveling by train through Japan and missed the official award ceremony on December 10th. After much controversy over whether he should be considered German or Swiss, the prize was accepted by the German ambassador, but he was listed as both nationalities in the official record. The formal presentation speech by Arrhenius, the committee chair, was carefully crafted. There is probably no physicist living today whose name has become so widely known as that of Albert Einstein, he began. Most discussion centers on his theory of relativity. He then went on to say, almost dismissively, that this pertains essentially to epistemology and has therefore been the subject of lively debate in philosophical circles. Einstein gave his official acceptance speech the following July at a Swedish science conference with King Gustav Adolf V in attendance. He spoke not about the photoelectric effect, but about relativity, and he concluded by emphasizing the importance of his new passion, finding a unified field theory that would reconcile general relativity with electromagnetic theory, and, if possible, with quantum mechanics. The prize money that year amounted to 121,572 Swedish kronor, or $32,250, which was more than 10 times the annual salary of the average professor at the time. As per his divorce agreement with Marich, Einstein had part of it sent directly to Zurich to reside in a trust for her and their sons, and the rest went into an American account with the interest directed for her use. This prompted another row. Hans Albert complained that the trust arrangement, which had previously been agreed to, made only the interest on the money accessible to the family. Once again, Zanger intervened and calmed the dispute. Einstein jokingly wrote to his sons, "You will all be so rich that some fine day I may ask you for a loan." The money was eventually used by Marich to buy 3 homes with rental apartments in Zurich. Newton's Bucket and the Ether Reincarnated. "Anything truly novel is invented only during one's youth," Einstein lamented to a friend after finishing his work on general relativity and cosmology. "Later one becomes more experienced, more famous, and more blockheaded." Einstein turned 40 in 1919, the year that the eclipse observations made him world famous. For the next 6 years, he continued to make important contributions to quantum theory. But after that, as we shall see, he would begin to seem, if not blockheaded, at least a bit stubborn as he resisted quantum mechanics and embarked on a long, lonely, and unsuccessful effort to devise a unified theory that would subsume it into a more deterministic framework. Over the ensuing years, researchers would discover new forces in nature, besides electromagnetism and gravity, and also new particles. These would make Einstein's attempts at unification all the more complex. But he would find himself less familiar with the latest data in experimental physics, and he thus would no longer have the same intuitive feel for how to wrest from nature her fundamental principles. If Einstein had retired after the eclipse observations and devoted himself to sailing for the remaining 36 years of his life, would science have suffered? Yes, for even though most of his attacks on quantum mechanics did not prove to be warranted, he did serve to strengthen the theory by coming up with a few advances, and also, less intentionally, by his ingenious but futile efforts to poke holes in it. That raises another question. Why was Einstein so much more creative before the age of 40 than after? Partly, it is an occupational hazard of mathematicians and theoretical physicists to have their great breakthroughs before turning 40. "The intellect gets crippled," Einstein explained to a friend, "but glittering renown is still draped around the calcified shell." More specifically, Einstein's scientific successes had come in part from his rebelliousness. There was a link between his creativity and his willingness to defy authority. He had no sentimental attachment to the old order, thus was energized by upending it. His stubbornness had worked to his advantage. But now, just as he had traded his youthful bohemian attitudes for the comforts of a bourgeois home, he had become wedded to the faith that field theories could preserve the certainties and determinism of classical science. His stubbornness, henceforth, would work to his disadvantage. It was a fate that he had begun fearing some years before, not long after he finished his famous flurry of 1905 papers. "Soon I will reach the age of stagnation and sterility, when one laments the revolutionary spirit of the young," he had worried to his colleague from the Olympia Academy, Maurice Sullivan. Now, many triumphs later, there were young revolutionaries who felt this fate had indeed befallen him. In one of his most revealing remarks about himself, Einstein lamented, "To punish me for my contempt of authority, fate has made me an authority myself." Thus, it is not surprising that during the 1920s, Einstein found himself scaling back on some of his bolder earlier ideas. For example, in his 1905 special relativity paper, he had famously dismissed the concept of the ether as superfluous. But after he finished his theory of general relativity, he concluded that the gravitational potentials in that theory characterized the physical qualities of empty space and served as a medium that could transmit disturbances. He began referring to this as a new way to conceive of the ether. "I agree with you that the general relativity theory admits of an ether hypothesis," he wrote Lorentz in 1916. In a lecture in Leiden in May 1920, Einstein publicly proposed a reincarnation, though not a rebirth, of the ether. More careful reflection teaches us, however, that the special theory of relativity does not compel us to deny ether, he said. "We may assume the existence of an ether, only we must give up ascribing a definite state of motion to it." This revised view was justified, he said, by the results of the general theory of relativity. He made clear that his new ether was different from the old one, which had been conceived as a medium that could ripple and thus explain how light waves moved through space. Instead, he was reintroducing the idea in order to explain rotation and inertia. Perhaps he could have saved some confusion if he had chosen a different term, but in his speech he made clear that he was reintroducing the word intentionally. "To deny the ether is ultimately to assume that empty space has no physical qualities whatever. The fundamental facts of mechanics do not harmonize with this view. Besides observable objects, another thing, which is not perceptible, must be looked upon as real, to enable acceleration or rotation to be looked upon as something real. The conception of the ether has again acquired an intelligible content, although this content differs widely from that of the ether of the mechanical wave theory of light. According to the general theory of relativity, space is endowed with physical qualities. In this sense, there exists an ether. Space without ether is unthinkable, for in such space, there not only would be no propagation of light, but also no possibility of existence for standards of space and time, measuring rods and clocks, nor, therefore, any space-time intervals in the physical sense. But this ether may not be thought of as endowed with the qualities of ponderable media, as consisting of parts which may be tracked through time. The idea of motion may not be applied to it. So what was this reincarnated ether, and what did it mean for Mach's principle and for the question raised by Newton's bucket? Einstein had initially enthused that general relativity explained rotation as being simply a motion relative to other objects in space, just as Mach had argued. In other words, if you were inside a bucket that was dangling in empty space, with no other objects in the universe, there would be no way to tell if you were spinning or not. Einstein even wrote to Mach saying he should be pleased that his principle was supported by general relativity. See chapter 9 for Newton's thought experiment about whether water rotating in a bucket in empty space would be subject to inertial pressure and thus press against the sides of the bucket. See chapter 11 for Einstein's 1916 view, which he was now revisiting, that an empty universe would have no inertia nor fabric of space-time. Einstein had asserted this claim in a letter to Schwarzschild, the brilliant young scientist who had written to him from Germany's Russian front during the war about the cosmological implications of general relativity. "Inertia is simply an interaction between masses, not an effect in which space of itself is involved, separate from the observed mass," Einstein had declared. But Schwarzschild disagreed with that assessment. And now, 4 years later, Einstein had changed his mind. In his Leiden speech, unlike in his 1916 interpretation of general relativity, Einstein accepted that his gravitational field theory implied that empty space had physical qualities. The mechanical behavior of an object hovering in empty space, like Newton's bucket, depends not only on relative velocities, but also on its state of rotation. And that meant space is endowed with physical qualities. As he admitted outright, this meant that he was now abandoning Mach's principle. Among other things, Mach's idea that inertia is caused by the presence of all of the distant bodies in the universe implied that these bodies could instantly have an effect on an object, even though they were far apart. Einstein's theory of relativity did not accept instant actions at a distance. Even gravity did not exert its force instantly, but only through changes in the gravitational field that obeyed the speed limit of light. Inertial resistance to acceleration, in relation to distant masses, supposes action at a distance, Einstein lectured. Because the modern physicist does not accept such a thing as action at a distance, he comes back to the ether, which has to serve as medium for the effects of inertia. It is an issue that still causes dispute, but Einstein seemed to believe, at least when he gave his Leiden lecture, that according to general relativity, as he now saw it, the water in Newton's bucket would be pushed up the walls even if it were spinning in a universe devoid of any other objects. In contradiction to what Mach would have predicted, Brian Green writes, even in an otherwise empty universe, you will feel pressed against the inner wall of the spinning bucket. In general relativity, empty space-time provides a benchmark for accelerated motion. The inertia pushing the water up the wall was caused by its rotation with respect to the metric field, which Einstein now reincarnated as an ether. As a result, he had to face the possibility that general relativity did not necessarily eliminate the concept of absolute motion, at least with respect to the metric of space-time. It was not exactly a retreat, nor a return to the 19th century concept of the ether. But it was a more conservative way of looking at the universe, and it represented a break from the radicalism of Mach that Einstein had once embraced. This clearly made Einstein uncomfortable. The best way to eliminate the need for an ether that existed separately from matter, he concluded, would be to find his elusive unified field theory. What a glory that would be! The contrast between ether and matter would fade away, he said. And through the general theory of relativity, the whole of physics would become a complete system of thought. Niels Bohr, lasers, and chance. By far the most important manifestation of Einstein's midlife transition from a revolutionary to a conservative was his hardening attitude toward quantum theory, which in the mid-1920s produced a radical new system of mechanics. His qualms about this new quantum mechanics and his search for a unifying theory that would reconcile it with relativity and restore certainty to nature would dominate, and to some extent diminish, the second half of his scientific career. He had once been a fearless quantum pioneer. Together with Max Planck, he launched the revolution at the beginning of the century. Unlike Planck, he had been one of the few scientists who truly believed in the physical reality of quanta, that light actually came in packets of energy. These quanta behaved at times like particles. They were indivisible units, not part of a continuum. In his 1909 Salzburg address, he had predicted that physics would have to reconcile itself to a duality in which light could be regarded as both wave and particle. And at the first Solvay conference in 1911, he had declared that these discontinuities, which we find so distasteful in Planck's theory, seem really to exist in nature. This caused Planck, who resisted the notion that his quanta actually had a physical reality, to say of Einstein in his recommendation that he be elected to the Prussian Academy, his hypothesis of light quanta may have gone overboard. Other scientists likewise resisted Einstein's quantum hypothesis. Walter Nernst called it probably the strangest thing ever thought up, and Robert Millikan called it wholly untenable, even after confirming its predictive power in his lab. A new phase of the quantum revolution was launched in 1913, when Niels Bohr came up with a revised model for the structure of the atom. 6 years younger than Einstein, brilliant, yet rather shy and inarticulate, Bohr was Danish, and thus able to draw from the work on quantum theory being done by Germans, such as Planck and Einstein, and also from the work on the structure of the atom being done by the Englishmen J. J. Thomson and Ernest Rutherford. At the time, quantum theory was a German invention, which had scarcely penetrated to England at all, recalled Arthur Eddington. Bohr had gone to study with Thomson in Cambridge, but the mumbling Dane and brusque Brit had trouble communicating. So Bohr migrated up to Manchester to work with the more gregarious Rutherford, who had devised a model of the atom that featured a positively charged nucleus around which tiny negatively charged electrons orbited. Bohr made a refinement based on the fact that these electrons did not collapse into the nucleus and emit a continuous spectrum of radiation, as classical physics would suggest. In Bohr's new model, which was based on studying the hydrogen atom, an electron circled a nucleus at certain permitted orbits in states with discrete energies. The atom could absorb energy from radiation, such as light, only in increments that would kick the electron up a notch to another permitted orbit. Likewise, the atom could emit radiation only in increments that would drop the electron down to another permitted orbit. When an electron moved from one orbit to the next, it was a quantum leap. In other words, it was a disconnected and discontinuous shift from one level to another, with no meandering in between. Bohr went on to show how this model accounted for the lines in the spectrum of light emitted by the hydrogen atom. Einstein was both impressed and a little jealous when he heard of Bohr's theory. As one scientist reported to Rutherford, he told me that he had once similar ideas, but he did not dare to publish them. Einstein later declared of Bohr's discovery, "This is the highest form of musicality in the sphere of thought." Einstein used Bohr's model as the foundation for a series of papers in 1916, the most important of which, On the Quantum Theory of Radiation, was also formally published in a journal in 1917. Einstein began with a thought experiment in which a chamber is filled with a cloud of atoms. They are being bathed by light, or any form of electromagnetic radiation. Einstein then combined Bohr's model of the atom with Max Planck's theory of the quanta. If each change in an electron orbit corresponded to the absorption or emission of one light quantum, then presto! It resulted in a new and better way to derive Planck's formula for explaining blackbody radiation. As Einstein boasted to Michele Besso, "A brilliant idea dawned on me about radiation absorption and emission. It will interest you. An astonishingly simple derivation, I should say the derivation of Planck's formula. A thoroughly quantized affair." Atoms emit radiation in a spontaneous fashion, but Einstein theorized that this process could also be stimulated. A roughly simplified way to picture this is to suppose that an atom is already in a high-energy state from having absorbed a photon. If another photon with a particular wavelength is then fired into it, two photons of the same wavelength and direction can be emitted. What Einstein discovered was slightly more complex. Suppose there is a gas of atoms with energy being pumped into it, say by pulses of electricity or light. Many of the atoms will absorb energy and go into a higher energy state, and they will begin to emit photons. Einstein argued that the presence of this cloud of photons made it even more likely that a photon of the same wavelength and direction as the other photons in the cloud would be emitted. This process of stimulated emission would, almost 40 years later, be the basis for the invention of the laser, an acronym for light amplification by the stimulated emission of radiation. There was one part of Einstein's quantum theory of radiation that had strange ramifications. "It can be demonstrated convincingly," he told Besso, "that the elementary processes of emission and absorption are directed processes." In other words, when a photon pulses out of an atom, it does not do so, as the classical wave theory would have it, in all directions at once. Instead, a photon has momentum. In other words, the equations work only if each quantum of radiation is emitted in some particular direction. That was not necessarily a problem, but here was the rub. There was no way to determine which direction an emitted photon might go. In addition, there was no way to determine when it would happen. If an atom was in a state of higher energy, it was possible to calculate the probability that it would emit a photon at any specific moment. But it was not possible to determine the moment of emission precisely. Nor was it possible to determine the direction, no matter how much information you had. It was all a matter of chance, like the roll of dice. That was a problem. It threatened the strict determinism of Newton's mechanics. It undermined the certainty of classical physics and the faith that if you knew all the positions and velocities in a system, you could determine its future. Relativity may have seemed like a radical idea, but at least it preserved rigid cause and effect rules. The quirky and unpredictable behavior of pesky quanta, however, was messing with this causality. It is a weakness of the theory, Einstein conceded, that it leaves the time and direction of the elementary process to chance. The whole concept of chance, Zufall was the word he used, was so disconcerting to him, so odd, that he put the word in quotation marks, as if to distance himself from it. For Einstein, and indeed for most classical physicists, the idea that there could be a fundamental randomness in the universe, that events could just happen without a cause, was not only a cause of discomfort, it undermined the entire program of physics. Indeed, he never would become reconciled to it. "The thing about causality plagues me very much," he wrote Max Born in 1920. "Is the quantum-like absorption and emission of light ever conceivable in terms of complete causality?" For the rest of his life, Einstein would remain resistant to the notion that probabilities and uncertainties ruled nature in the realm of quantum mechanics. "I find the idea quite intolerable that an electron exposed to radiation should choose, of its own free will, not only its moment to jump off, but also its direction," he despaired to Born a few years later. "In that case, I would rather be a cobbler or even an employee of a gaming house than a physicist." Philosophically, Einstein's reaction seemed to be an echo of the attitude displayed by the anti-relativists, who interpreted or misinterpreted Einstein's relativity theory as meaning an end to the certainties and absolutes in nature. In fact, Einstein saw relativity theory as leading to a deeper description of certainties and absolutes, what he called invariances, based on the combination of space and time into one four-dimensional fabric. Quantum mechanics, on the other hand, would be based on true underlying uncertainties in nature, events that could be described only in terms of probabilities. On a visit to Berlin in 1920, Niels Bohr, who had become the Copenhagen-based ringleader of the quantum mechanics movement, met Einstein for the first time. Bohr arrived at Einstein's apartment bearing Danish cheese and butter, and then he launched into a discussion of the role that chance and probability played in quantum mechanics. Einstein expressed his wariness of abandoning continuity and causality. Bohr was bolder about going into that misty realm. "Abandoning strict causality," he countered to Einstein, "was the only way open, given the evidence." Einstein admitted that he was impressed, but also worried by Bohr's breakthroughs on the structure of the atom and the randomness it implied for the quantum nature of radiation. "I could probably have arrived at something like this myself," Einstein lamented. "But if all this is true, then it means the end of physics." Although Einstein found Bohr's ideas disconcerting, he found the gangly and informal Dane personally endearing. "Not often in life has a human being caused me such joy by his mere presence as you did," he wrote Bohr right after the visit, adding that he took pleasure in picturing your cheerful, boyish face. He was equally effusive behind Bohr's back. "Bohr was here, and I am just as keen on him as you are," he wrote their mutual friend Ehrenfest in Leiden. "He is an extremely sensitive lad, and moves around in this world as if in a trance." Bohr, for his part, revered Einstein. When it was announced in 1922 that they had won sequential Nobel Prizes, Bohr wrote that his own joy had been heightened by the fact that Einstein had been recognized first for the fundamental contribution that you made to the special field in which I am working. On his journey home from delivering his acceptance speech in Sweden the following summer, Einstein stopped in Copenhagen to see Bohr, who met him at the train station to take him home by streetcar. On the ride, they got into a debate. "We took the streetcar and talked so animatedly that we went much too far," Bohr recalled. "We got off and traveled back, but again rode too far. Neither seemed to mind, for the conversation was so engrossing. We rode to and fro, according to Bohr, and I can well imagine what the people thought about us." More than just a friendship, their relationship became an intellectual entanglement that began with divergent views about quantum mechanics, but then expanded into related issues of science, knowledge, and philosophy. In all the history of human thought, there is no greater dialogue than that which took place over the years between Niels Bohr and Albert Einstein about the meaning of the quantum, says the physicist John Wheeler, who studied under Bohr. The social philosopher C.P. Snow went further. "No more profound intellectual debate has ever been conducted," he proclaimed. Their dispute went to the fundamental heart of the design of the cosmos. Was there an objective reality that existed whether or not we could ever observe it? Were there laws that restored strict causality to phenomena that seemed inherently random? Was everything in the universe predetermined? For the rest of their lives, Bohr would sputter and fret at his repeated failures to convert Einstein to quantum mechanics. "Einstein, Einstein, Einstein," he would mutter after each infuriating encounter. But it was a discussion that was conducted with deep affection and even great humor. On one of the many occasions when Einstein declared that God would not play dice, it was Bohr who countered with the famous rejoinder, "Einstein, stop telling God what to do." Quantum leaps. Unlike the development of relativity theory, which was largely the product of one man working in near solitary splendor, the development of quantum mechanics in 1924 to 1927 came from a burst of activity by a clamorous congregation of young Turks who worked both in parallel and in collaboration. They built on the foundations laid by Planck and Einstein, who continued to resist the radical ramifications of the quanta, and on the breakthroughs by Bohr, who served as a mentor for the new generation. Louis de Broglie, who carried the title of prince by virtue of being related to the deposed French royal family, studied history in hopes of being a civil servant. But after college, he became fascinated by physics. His doctoral dissertation in 1924 helped transform the field. "If a wave can behave like a particle," he asked, "shouldn't a particle also behave like a wave?" In other words, Einstein had said that light should be regarded not only as a wave, but also as a particle. Likewise, according to de Broglie, a particle such as an electron could also be regarded as a wave. "I had a sudden inspiration," de Broglie later recalled. Einstein's wave-particle dualism was an absolutely general phenomenon extending to all of physical nature. And that being the case, the motion of all particles, photons, electrons, protons, or any other, must be associated with the propagation of a wave. Using Einstein's law of the photoelectric effect, de Broglie showed that the wavelength associated with any electron, or any particle, would be related to Planck's constant divided by the particle's momentum. It turns out to be an incredibly tiny wavelength, which means that it's usually relevant only to particles in the subatomic realm, not to such things as pebbles or planets or baseballs. The de Broglie wavelength of a baseball thrown at 90 miles per hour would be about 10 to the minus 34 meters, incredibly smaller than the size of an atom or even a proton, so infinitesimal as to be unobservable. In Bohr's model of the atom, electrons would change their orbits, or more precisely, their stable standing wave patterns, only by certain quantum leaps. De Broglie's thesis helped explain this by conceiving of electrons not just as particles, but also as waves. Those waves are strung out over the circular path around the nucleus. This works only if the circle accommodates a whole number, such as 2 or 3 or 4, of the particle's wavelengths. It won't neatly fit in the prescribed circle if there's a fraction of a wavelength left over. De Broglie made 3 typed copies of his thesis, and sent one to his advisor, Paul Langevin, who was Einstein's friend and Madame Curie's. Langevin, somewhat baffled, asked for another copy to send along to Einstein, who praised the work effusively. It had, Einstein said, lifted a corner of the great veil. As de Broglie proudly noted, this made Langevin accept my work. Einstein made his own contribution when he received in June 1924 a paper in English from a young physicist from India named Satyendra Nath Bose. It derived Planck's blackbody radiation law by treating radiation as if it were a cloud of gas, and then applying a statistical method of analyzing it. But there was a twist. Bose said that any two photons that had the same energy state were absolutely indistinguishable, in theory as well as fact, and should not be treated separately in the statistical calculations. Bose's creative use of statistical analysis was reminiscent of Einstein's youthful enthusiasm for that approach. He not only got Bose's paper published, he also extended it with three papers of his own. In them, he applied Bose's counting method, later called Bose-Einstein statistics, to actual gas molecules, thus becoming the primary inventor of quantum statistical mechanics. Bose's paper dealt with photons, which have no mass. Einstein extended the idea by treating quantum particles with mass as being indistinguishable from one another for statistical purposes in certain cases. The quanta, or molecules, are not treated as structures statistically independent of one another, he wrote. The key insight, which Einstein extracted from Bose's initial paper, has to do with how you calculate the probabilities for each possible state of multiple quantum particles. To use an analogy suggested by the Yale physicist Douglas Stone, imagine how this calculation is done for dice. In calculating the odds that the roll of two dice, A and B, will produce a lucky 7, we treat the possibility that A comes up 4 and B comes up 3 as one outcome, and we treat the possibility that A comes up 3 and B comes up 4 as a different outcome, thus counting each of these combinations as different ways to produce a 7. Einstein realized that the new way of calculating the odds of quantum states involved treating these not as two different possibilities, but only as one. A 4-3 combination was indistinguishable from a 3-4 combination. Likewise, a 5-2 combination was indistinguishable from a 2-5. That cuts in half the number of ways two dice can roll a 7. But it does not affect the number of ways they could turn up a 2 or a 12. Using either counting method, there is only one way to roll each of these totals. And it only reduces from 5 to 3 the number of ways the two dice could total 6. A few minutes of jotting down possible outcomes shows how this system changes the overall odds of rolling any particular number. The changes wrought by this new calculating method are even greater if we are applying it to dozens of dice. And if we are dealing with billions of particles, the change in probabilities becomes huge. When he applied this approach to a gas of quantum particles, Einstein discovered an amazing property. Unlike a gas of classical particles, which will remain a gas unless the particles attract one another, a gas of quantum particles can condense into some kind of liquid even without a force of attraction between them. This phenomenon, now called Bose-Einstein condensation, was a brilliant and important discovery in quantum mechanics, and Einstein deserves most of the credit for it. Bose had not quite realized that the statistical mathematics he used represented a fundamentally new approach. As with the case of Planck's constant, Einstein recognized the physical reality and the significance of a contrivance that someone else had devised. In 1995, Bose-Einstein condensation was finally achieved experimentally by Eric A. Cornell, Wolfgang Ketterle, and Carl E. Wieman, who were awarded the 2001 Nobel Prize for this work. Einstein's method had the effect of treating particles as if they had wave-like traits, as both he and de Broglie had suggested. Einstein even predicted that if you did Thomas Young's old double-slit experiment, showing that light behaved like a wave by shining a beam through two slits and noting the interference pattern, by using a beam of gas molecules, they would interfere with one another as if they were waves. A beam of gas molecules, which passes through an aperture, he wrote, must undergo a diffraction analogous to that of a light ray. Amazingly, Experiments soon showed that to be true. Despite his discomfort with the direction quantum theory was heading, Einstein was still helping, at least for the time being, to push it ahead. Einstein is thereby clearly involved in the foundation of wave mechanics, his friend Max Born later said, and no alibi can disprove it. Einstein admitted that he found this mutual influence of particles to be quite mysterious, for they seemed as if they should behave independently. The quanta, or molecules, are not treated as independent of one another, he wrote another physicist who expressed bafflement. In a postscript, he admitted that it all worked well mathematically, but the physical nature remains veiled. On the surface, this assumption that two particles could be treated as indistinguishable violated a principle that Einstein would nevertheless try to cling to in the future. The principle of separability, which asserts that particles with different locations in space have separate, independent realities. One aim of general relativity's theory of gravity had been to avoid any spooky action at a distance, as Einstein famously called it later, in which something happening to one body could instantly affect another distant body. Once again, Einstein was at the forefront of discovering an aspect of quantum theory that would cause him discomfort in the future. And, once again, younger colleagues would embrace his ideas more readily than he would, just as he had once embraced the implications of the ideas of Planck, Poincaré, and Lorentz more readily than they had. An additional step was taken by another unlikely player, Erwin Schrödinger, an Austrian theoretical physicist who despaired of discovering anything significant and thus decided to concentrate on being a philosopher instead. But the world apparently already had enough Austrian philosophers, and he couldn't find work in that field, so he stuck with physics, and inspired by Einstein's praise of de Broglie, came up with a theory called wave mechanics. It led to a set of equations that governed de Broglie's wave-like behavior of electrons, which Schrödinger, giving half credit where he thought it was due, called Einstein-de Broglie waves. Einstein expressed enthusiasm at first, but he soon became troubled by some of the ramifications of Schrödinger's waves, most notably that over time they can spread over an enormous area. An electron could not, in reality, be waving thus, Einstein thought. So what in the real world did the wave equation really represent? The person who helped answer that question was Max Born, Einstein's close friend and, along with his wife Hedwig, frequent correspondent, who was then teaching at Göttingen. Born proposed that the wave did not describe the behavior of the particle. Instead, he said that it described the probability of its location at any moment. It was an approach that revealed quantum mechanics as being, even more than previously thought, fundamentally based on chance rather than causal certainties, and it made Einstein even more squeamish. Meanwhile, another approach to quantum mechanics had been developed in the summer of 1925, by a bright-faced 23-year-old hiking enthusiast, Werner Heisenberg, who was a student of Niels Bohr in Copenhagen and then of Max Born in Göttingen. As Einstein had done in his more radical youth, Heisenberg started by embracing Ernst Mach's dictum that theory should avoid any concepts that cannot be observed, measured, or verified. For Heisenberg, this meant avoiding the concept of electron orbits, which could not be observed. He relied instead on a mathematical approach that would account for something that could be observed, the wavelengths of the spectral lines of the radiation from these electrons as they lost energy. The result was so complex that Heisenberg gave his paper to Born and left on a camping trip with fellow members of his youth group, hoping that his mentor could figure it out. Born did. The math involved what are known as matrices, and Born sorted it all out and got the paper published. In collaboration with Born and others in Göttingen, Heisenberg went on to perfect a matrix mechanics that was later shown to be equivalent to Schrödinger's wave mechanics. Einstein politely wrote Born's wife Hedwig, "The Heisenberg-Born concepts leave us breathless." Those carefully couched words can be read in a variety of ways. Writing to Ehrenfest in Leiden, Einstein was more blunt. "Heisenberg has laid a big quantum egg," he wrote. "In Göttingen, they believe in it. I don't." Heisenberg's more famous and disruptive contribution came 2 years later, in 1927. It is, to the general public, one of the best-known and most baffling aspects of quantum physics, the uncertainty principle. It is impossible to know, Heisenberg declared, the precise position of a particle, such as a moving electron, and its precise momentum, its velocity times its mass, at the same instant. The more precisely the position of the particle is measured, the less precisely it is possible to measure its momentum. And the formula that describes the trade-off involves, no surprise, Planck's constant. The very act of observing something, of allowing photons or electrons or any other particles or waves of energy to strike the object, affects the observation. But Heisenberg's theory went beyond that. An electron does not have a definite position or path until we observe it. This is a feature of our universe, he said, not merely some defect in our observing or measuring abilities. The uncertainty principle, so simple and yet so startling, was a stake in the heart of classical physics. It asserts that there is no objective reality, not even an objective position of a particle outside of our observations. In addition, Heisenberg's principle and other aspects of quantum mechanics undermine the notion that the universe obeys strict causal laws. Chance, indeterminacy, and probability took the place of certainty. When Einstein wrote him a note objecting to these features, Heisenberg replied bluntly, "I believe that indeterminism, that is, the non-validity of rigorous causality, is necessary." When Heisenberg came to give a lecture in Berlin in 1926, he met Einstein for the first time. Einstein invited him over to his house one evening, and there they engaged in a friendly argument. It was the mirror of the type of argument Einstein might have had in 1905 with conservatives who resisted his dismissal of the ether. "We cannot observe electron orbits inside the atom," Heisenberg said. "A good theory must be based on directly observable magnitudes." "But you don't seriously believe," Einstein protested, "that none but observable magnitudes must go into a physical theory." "Isn't that precisely what you have done with relativity?" Heisenberg asked in some surprise. "Possibly I did use this kind of reasoning," Einstein admitted, "but it is nonsense all the same." In other words, Einstein's approach had evolved. Einstein had a similar conversation with his friend in Prague, Philipp Frank. "A new fashion has arisen in physics," Einstein complained, "which declares that certain things cannot be observed and therefore should not be ascribed reality." "But the fashion you speak of," Frank protested, "was invented by you in 1905. Replied Einstein, "A good joke should not be repeated too often." The theoretical advances that occurred in the mid-1920s were shaped by Niels Bohr and his colleagues, including Heisenberg, into what became known as the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics. A property of an object can be discussed only in the context of how that property is observed or measured. And these observations are not simply aspects of a single picture, but are complementary to one another. In other words, there is no single underlying reality that is independent of our observations. It is wrong to think that the task of physics is to find out how nature is, Bohr declared. Physics concerns what we can say about nature. This inability to know a so-called underlying reality meant that there was no strict determinism in the classical sense. When one wishes to calculate the future from the present, one can only get statistical results, Heisenberg said, since one can never discover every detail of the present. As this revolution climaxed in the spring of 1927, Einstein used the 200th anniversary of Newton's death to defend the classical system of mechanics based on causality and certainty. 2 decades earlier, Einstein had, with youthful insouciance, toppled many of the pillars of Newton's universe, including absolute space and time. But now he was a defender of the established order, and of Newton. In the new quantum mechanics, he said, strict causality seemed to disappear. "But the last word has not been said," Einstein argued. "May the spirit of Newton's method give us the power to restore union between physical reality and the profoundest characteristic of Newton's teaching, strict causality. Einstein never fully came around, even as experiments repeatedly showed quantum mechanics to be valid. He remained a realist, one who made it his creed to believe in an objective reality, rooted in certainty, that existed whether or not we could observe it. He does not play dice. So what made Einstein cede the revolutionary road to younger radicals and spin into a defensive crouch? As a young empiricist, excited by his readings of Ernst Mach, Einstein had been willing to reject any concepts that could not be observed, such as the ether and absolute time and space and simultaneity. But the success of his general theory convinced him that Mach's skepticism, even though it might be useful for weeding out superfluous concepts, did not provide much help in constructing new theories. He rides Mach's poor horse to exhaustion, Einstein complained to Michele Besso about a paper written by a mutual friend. We should not insult Mach's poor horse, Besso replied. Didn't it make possible the tortuous journey through the relativities? And who knows, in the case of the nasty quanta, it may also carry Don Quixote de la Einsteina through it all. You know what I think about Mach's little horse, Einstein wrote Besso in return. It cannot give birth to anything living. It can only exterminate harmful vermin. In his maturity, Einstein more firmly believed that there was an objective reality that existed whether or not we could observe it. The belief in an external world independent of the person observing it, he repeatedly said, was the basis of all science. In addition, Einstein resisted quantum mechanics because it abandoned strict causality and instead defined reality in terms of indeterminacy, uncertainty, and probability. A true disciple of Hume would not have been troubled by this. There is no real reason, other than either a metaphysical faith or a habit ingrained in the mind, to believe that nature must operate with absolute certainty. It is just as reasonable, though perhaps less satisfying, to believe that some things simply happened by chance. Certainly there was mounting evidence that on the subatomic level this was the case. But for Einstein this simply did not smell true. The ultimate goal of physics, he repeatedly said, was to discover the laws that strictly determine causes and effects. I'm very, very reluctant to give up complete causality, he told Max Born. His faith in determinism and causality reflected that of his favorite religious philosopher, Baruch Spinoza. He was utterly convinced, Einstein wrote of Spinoza, of the causal dependence of all phenomena. At a time when the successive efforts to achieve a knowledge of the causal relationship of natural phenomena was still quite modest. It was a sentence that Einstein could have written about himself, emphasizing the temporariness implied by the word still after the advent of quantum mechanics. Like Spinoza, Einstein did not believe in a personal God who interacted with man, but they both believed that a divine design was reflected in the elegant laws that governed the way the universe worked. This was not merely some expression of faith. It was a principle that Einstein elevated, as he had the relativity principle, to the level of a postulate, one that guided him in his work. When I am judging a theory, he told his friend Banish Hoffmann, I ask myself whether, if I were God, I would have arranged the world in such a way. When he posed that question, there was one possibility that he simply could not believe, that the good Lord would have created beautiful and subtle rules that determined most of what happened in the universe, while leaving a few things completely to chance. It felt wrong. If the Lord had wanted to do that, he would have done it thoroughly and not kept to a pattern. He would have gone the whole hog. In that case, we wouldn't have to look for laws at all. This led to one of Einstein's most famous quotes, written to Max Born, the friend and physicist who would spar with him over 3 decades on this topic. Quantum mechanics is certainly imposing, Einstein said, but an inner voice tells me that it is not yet the real thing. The theory says a lot, but it does not really bring us any closer to the secrets of the old one. I, at any rate, am convinced that he does not play dice. Thus it was that Einstein ended up deciding that quantum mechanics, though it may not be wrong, was at least incomplete. There must be a fuller explanation of how the universe operates, one that would incorporate both relativity theory and quantum mechanics. In doing so, it would not leave things to chance. Chapter 15. Unified Field Theories, 1923-1931. The Quest. While others continued to develop quantum mechanics, undaunted by the uncertainties at its core, Einstein persevered in his lonelier quest for a more complete explanation of the universe. A unified field theory that would tie together electricity and magnetism and gravity and quantum mechanics. In the past, his genius had been in finding missing links between different theories. The opening sentences of his 1905 General Relativity and Light Quanta papers were such examples. From his 1905 Special Relativity paper, it is well known that Maxwell's electrodynamics, as usually understood now, when applied to moving bodies, leads to asymmetries that do not seem inherent in the phenomenon. Take, for example, the electrodynamic interaction between a magnet and a conductor. From the 1905 Light Quanta paper, a profound formal difference exists between the theories that physicists have formed about gases and other ponderable bodies and Maxwell's theory of electromagnetic processes in so-called empty space. He hoped to extend the gravitational field equations of general relativity so that they would describe the electromagnetic field as well. The mind, striving after unification, cannot be satisfied that two fields should exist which, by their nature, are quite independent, Einstein explained in his Nobel lecture. We seek a mathematically unified field theory, in which the gravitational field and the electromagnetic field are interpreted only as different components or manifestations of the same uniform field. Such a unified theory, he hoped, might make quantum mechanics compatible with relativity. He publicly enlisted Planck in this task with a toast at his mentor's 60th birthday celebration in 1918. May he succeed in uniting quantum theory with electrodynamics and mechanics in a single logical system. Einstein's quest was primarily a procession of false steps marked by increasing mathematical complexity that began with his reacting to the false steps of others. The first was by the mathematical physicist Hermann Weyl, who, in 1918, proposed a way to extend the geometry of general relativity that would, so it seemed, serve as a geometrization of the electromagnetic field as well. Einstein was initially impressed. It's a first-class stroke of genius, he told Weyl. But he had one problem with it. I have not been able to settle my measuring rod objection yet. Under Weyl's theory, measuring rods and clocks would vary depending on the path they took through space. But experimental observations showed no such phenomenon. In his next letter, after two more days of reflection, Einstein pricked his bubbles of praise with a wry put-down. Your chain of reasoning is so wonderfully self-contained, he wrote Weyl, except for agreeing with reality, it is certainly a grand intellectual achievement. Next came a proposal in 1919 by Theodor Kaluza, a mathematics professor in Königsberg, that a fifth dimension be added to the four dimensions of space-time. Kaluza further posited that this added spatial dimension was circular, meaning that if you head in its direction, you get back to where you started, just like walking around the circumference of a cylinder. Kaluza did not try to describe the physical reality or location of this added spatial dimension. He was, after all, a mathematician, so he didn't have to. Instead, he devised it as a mathematical device. The metric of Einstein's four-dimensional space-time required 10 quantities to describe all the possible coordinate relationships for any point. Kaluza knew that 15 such quantities are needed to specify the geometry for a five-dimensional realm. When he played with the math of this complex construction, Kaluza found that 4 of the extra 5 quantities could be used to produce Maxwell's electromagnetic equations. At least mathematically, This might be a way to produce a field theory unifying gravity and electromagnetism. Once again, Einstein was both impressed and critical. "A five-dimensional cylinder world never dawned on me," he wrote Kaluza. "At first glance, I like your idea enormously." Unfortunately, there was no reason to believe that most of this math actually had any basis in physical reality. With the luxury of being a pure mathematician, Kaluza admitted this and challenged the physicists to figure it out. It is still hard to believe that all of these relations in their virtually unsurpassed formal unity should amount to the mere alluring play of a capricious accident, he wrote. Should more than an empty mathematical formalism be found to reside behind these presumed connections, we would then face a new triumph of Einstein's general relativity. By then, Einstein had become a convert to the faith in mathematical formalism, which had proven so useful in his final push toward general relativity. Once a few issues were sorted out, he helped Kaluza get his paper published in 1921 and followed up later with his own pieces. The next contribution came from the physicist Oscar Klein, son of Sweden's first rabbi and a student of Niels Bohr. Klein saw a unified field theory not only as a way to unite gravity and electromagnetism, but he also hoped it might explain some of the mysteries lurking in quantum mechanics. Perhaps it could even come up with a way to find hidden variables that could eliminate the uncertainty. Klein was more of a physicist than a mathematician, so he focused more than Kaluza had on what the physical